Good morning, everyone. I didn't really know what kind of presentation to prepare because I don't know you. And so what I did is make three different stories, and we can start with a kind of vote which ones you want to hear about, right? And threading is one of them, but the last one, this conserved domain database, is actually what we're working on now. And threading is part of it, as is how you compare structures with each other. So the first two topics are kind of methods, if you think of it. And the last one is an application in biology.
So yesterday we learned the structure-structure comparison with that marker thing.
okay. Right. So if you want, you n don't want another flavor of that, then
I go for number three, but it's
Is it an open vote or
So he gets
three different than that,
Well, they kind of connect to each other, but I can
how many hours?
It's a quick number one and number two, and then
Yeah.
maybe then second hour number.
All right, let's do that. So you get a different ver so you've heard about structure-structure comparison, so I'll go quick on that. And the reason I put it there is actually there's a, I think it's a very interesting statistics story. So okay, I'll just go. So first two topics in the first 50 minutes, no longer, then we'll do the last one. Okay. So structure-structure comparison. These are the questions biologists I tend to think about. When are two protein structures similar enough that this is interesting? Every protein has a helix, so that's not actually very interesting. So at what point does it become interesting? And then the second question is really for biologists. Homology means descent from a common ancestor, means some possibility of similar biological functions. So when is the similarity of two proteins enough that it actually suggests homology? And that's a very not very difficult problem. So these are kind of the questions I think that I like to start with for that problem. So let me show a little quick example of how you use the structure similarity, and this is going to be some screen captures from the search service that the unit I work in runs. And this is what the Entrée does. It's a kind of browser for different biological databases, and you can query by term any of the databases like Medline abstracts or 3D structures. And these link to one another. So if you want to look for a paper about a structure, then you want to see the structure, you can look up the paper, then link over to the structure. Then there also are these neighboring relationships, the little arrows, that all of the like objects in the different databases have been compared to one another automatically, so that one can find related structures, related sequences, even related abstracts. So I'll just do a little story about using the structure neighbors. And this is a very biological one. This was actually a real story. Suppose I was trying to find out whether I could better understand the mechanism of a genetic disease, something called nail patella syndrome, and I looked up some papers about it. I then asked, okay, to just tell the story, this is it's a single missense. Single substitution in one gene in humans leads to a disease phenotype. And so I want to go from having looked up papers about this over to sequences, so you push the protein links. Well, actually, this is looking at the paper. You can push the protein links and then protein neighbors, get related ones, and get a whole list of sequences similar to the human gene. And this can then ask, well, okay, what am I doing? The story is find the human gene, go find which amino acid in this great long protein was the one responsible for the disease, and just remember it, it's where that asparagine was. Then ask, find me any proteins of known structure that are related, meaning look among the sequence neighbors, ask if any of them has a known structure. This is display structure links. The system makes that easy to do. And there are a couple that are found, including this structure of 1FJL. It's a Drosophila protein that is homologous to the human protein. And using the entree, you can get these 3D views of the protein. And what I've done is construct, ask the viewer to align the human protein in the bottom here with the Drosophila one, and what one sees is that residue is directly in the DNA binding interface. And so one could imagine that if it's changed from an asparagine, which is actually conserved between the human and fly orthologue of this protein, then it would affect the biological function. So you have immediate a hypothesis coming from just knowing the structure, where how this that it would be a loss of function phenotype associated with that.
What is mutation 2 in the disease?
Mutation 2.
In other words, if it's not an asparagine anymore.
I think it's it goes to a lysine, if I recall. We could actually can back up and read in the paper. Yeah. Okay. So that's so far just using sequence neighbors and visualizing the structure. The structure neighbors come in to try and ask whether this that particular part of the DNA binding interface is actually conserved across a bigger family of proteins. So you click another button that says show me the structure neighbors of this Drosophila protein. There's a great list of them. And you can then ask the same viewer to do a display that shows the related structures. And in this case, it's a very diverse set, not all of which are even detected as similar by sequence comparison. But when you have a look at the 3D image, one finds that, again, this asparagine here is conserved across the whole set of proteins, or at least this subset of the ones that are have structure have were detected by structure neighboring. So the application here of looking at the related structures is really very biological, in the sense it's saying that the mode of interaction of the protein with its substrate is actually preserved across a very long evolutionary distance, and that's what having the structure neighbors tells you, that the proteins here, there's several different ones. I don't know if that's clear to everyone. You can tell the viewer to bounce around and sort of show a little movie of how different proteins dock to the DNA. And the mode of interaction stays the same. That is, the function, you know, the interaction between the DNA and the protein is actually homologous across this set. And that residue is doing the same job across the set. And so this is the thing that having related structures is very useful. Having structure neighbors is useful for the biologist, to let you look at conservation of really functional properties. I mean, you also can find more remote neighbors, because some of these proteins, the sequences are not similar enough to necessarily have detected them by comparing sequences. But I think this checking that functional properties remain the same is really the thing that's most relevant to biologists. Okay, right, and having found the structure neighbors, you can go back, look at articles about them, and I'll skip that part. So, no, that is an existing software tool. Everything you do there, anyone can and does do on the web. This is called Entree. It's and the 3D viewing is a helper application. There's a download me button that you find on Entree, and it will. I mean, I made that slide by just using the public services and capturing the screen pictures for the PowerPoint. So yeah, everything there is already exists. There's nothing. This was just the URL, how you can go to get information about structured neighbors. There's it's actually closer to 30 million now superpositions of proteins recorded inside this set. So no human will ever look at them all. And those are just the ones that are significant, right? In order, there's roughly 50,000, it's over 40,000 domains now in our set that is domains of known structure. When you compare them all against all, you're running close to 2 billion structure-structure comparisons. So that's what's actually had to go on behind this. And then about, 10, 20 million of those are significant according to the threshold of statistical surprising similarity of proteins, which is what the talk is going to be about. Pairwise comparison of structures, yes. So anyway, I was going to quickly try and tell you how we approach this problem.
In sequence alignment, sometimes with multiple sequence alignment, you will get more information, pick up weak signals.
Yes.
Do you do this in structure alignment? Is that analog?
I'll tell you something about that. Let me remember to tell you at the end, if that's okay. Again, these are more questions about structure comparison. The thing about it that's very different than sequence comparison is that the structures are phenotypes. They're like the bones of a skeleton. And so when you decide that a dinosaur's hip bone looks like a bird's hip bone, well, you actually have to put in a lot of knowledge about, well, what aspect of the bone do I measure? What are the important features to look at? And comparing structures, although some people may not don't like to say it that way, it's exactly the same problem. You have to decide what it is you're going to look at, because they are phenotypes, they're skeletons. Whereas when you compare sequences, it's a genotype. You can imagine what you're doing is a measure of genetic edit distance, but that's not true for comparing structures. So you always have decisions, and the different methods of how you compare structures usually, I think, can be best understood as different decisions about what features of structure are relevant in the comparison. So I'll tell you how, make a point. We look back here at this protein, Drosophila, 1FGL, which is this homeobox protein. If you look down all these lists of structure neighbors in VAST, you see subdomain of DNA binding protein, and another homeobox protein, a ribosomal protein, also binding nucleic acid. All of these are DNA or RNA binding proteins that appear in the list of structure neighbors from VAST. If you take the same query, 1FJL, Drosophila homeobox protein, and send it off to another structure comparison method, this is the one done by Phil Bourne and colleagues at PEB, you actually get a completely different list of related proteins. It says that the most similar neighbor is tropomyosin, which if you're a biologist, you would say, well, tropomyosin occurs in your muscles. It doesn't bind DNA. It doesn't have anything to do with DNA binding. Next protein, leucine zipper. Well, those occur in DNA binding proteins, but the zipper is not the part that binds DNA. It's a protein-protein docking. Then synaptobrevin, it's a fibrous protein. Fibritin, so this list of structured neighbors does not intersect at all with the one that I showed you before. So if one thinks this is a trivial problem, what aspect of proteins should one look at in comparing structures? Well, here you have two public services that give totally diametrically opposite answers to the same question.
Which one should we use?
Well, I'll let you judge. So why does the CE method of Phil Bourne and so on say that the DNA binding protein looks like tropomyosin? Well, the answer is that it has a long helix in it. And so their method is basically looking for at the level of the backbone amino acid alpha carbon overlap, long pieces that overlap well without Without gaps. And so their method does what they told it to do. It is indeed true that the most residues overlapped with the smallest, you know, residuals without, in a continuous piece, is that piece of helix. So the DNA binding protein actually has a long helix in it. It's between the two domains that bind the DNA. Tropomyosin is a great long helix that's part of your muscle fibers. So their method did exactly what they told it to do.
This is about the calcium binding proteins, right? And when it binds calcium, doesn't it sort of completely ruin that helix?
No, that's calmodulin. Tropomyosin
sort of
does.
Same structure, though, don't they?
No, I think tropomyosin is just it's a fibrous protein. Anyway, I think the previous list saying that the DNA binding proteins are conserved, as in that example I showed you with the asparagine sitting there, that was a useful list of structured neighbors for a biologist. This one, I think, I would argue, isn't a particularly useful list for a biologist because it's just saying, well, sure, all helices look alike. That's built into the physics of polypeptide conformation. So you really didn't even need to do this search to know that. But anyway, two different answers from two different services. So, all right, how does the method we do work? The basic idea is to say that proteins look similar if and only if they have a similar arrangement of secondary structure elements, SSEs. And so one helix superimposing on one helix doesn't count as a similarity. We actually have to have a disposition of several of these in similar ways. And so that's why the list from FAST method is different than the one from the CE method.
So
the basic.
This method would distinguish between a helix bundle and a 1,000 helix bundle?
Yeah, sure. Because they're different arrangements of the SSEs. It considers both the directionality of the chain, the connectivity in the chain, and the orientation. So that's the proposed metric. And so the difference in those lists, while I'll go tell you more about the statistics and so on, the reason the VAST method looks different than the CE method has entirely to do with this basic definition of what is it, how do you measure similarity. And
when you call it similarity or neighbors, you consider the relative degree of the difference. You say, I'm in the sense of something is a very similar, something is a very similar.
Sure. Yeah, I'll come to that. There's a whole scale of method, a question of how you do a metric. And, okay, so one part of how VAST works is to look for these similarities quickly, because as I was started out, we've done 2 billion of these comparisons to maintain the neighbor database in Entree. So in the real world, that means you have to spend no more than about a tenth of a second per comparison. And so you have to have algorithms to go fast, and basically, right, this is the definition of similarity I was telling you.
So core is defined as beta sheets and alpha helices.
The idea here is just what I was saying. Your two proteins are similar if and only if they have a similar arrangement of the axial vectors of these secondary structure elements. So we simplify the representation.
Secondary structure elements are beta sheets and alpha helices.
Beta sheets and alpha helices only.
Each alpha helix, you just use a vector.
Yep. And each beta strand, you just use a vector. And sometimes they're bent, and this is an issue, of course, in this kind of method. But you assume that you can decompose the protein into a small number of linear elements, and then you can look for matches of them. That's what allows you to go fast in the comparison. You simplify the representation. Then the algorithm is basically subgraph isomorphism. Detect cliques, you make a comparison graph. I won't go over that. There's lots of papers about it. It's basically the comparison graph is nodes represent the alignment or matching of one vector, SSE vector, in one protein with another SSE vector in another. In the other protein, you draw an edge between whenever the relative orientation of the two vectors is the same to a threshold, a very low loose threshold. A clique then means an alignment of these vectors. And so that's the way you do this problem, to get rapidly throw away the proteins that don't share similarity and detect the possible alignments when they do.
What do you think the
You do internal coordinates. You make, look at, you define one distance and three angles representing the relative orientation. And then you have four scalars that you can just do a difference and say, okay, these two helices in this protein superimpose on these two helices in the other one, because the distance between their centers is similar, because the torsion angles describing their orientation are similar. So that's and you use very loose thresholds for all of that so that you don't throw away any possibly meaningful alignment. Then the second step I'll describe, you have to score them and sort them out of the various possible alignments between two proteins, which one is the best. But yes, right. There is no gap penalty. You just look for cliques, meaning alignments of different SSEs, and there is no cost whatsoever to omitting pieces, although that affects the statistics, as I'll describe. Okay, how do we score the different matches? This clique detection just gives us candidates. For any two big proteins, you'll get Avogadro's number of candidates, because proteins all have beta sheets. If they have helices, it's not too unlikely for some of them to be oriented similarly. So you always get lots of candidates, Avogadro's number of them when there's a big. So the question for this method is to sort out and find the best one. So there's a scoring scheme that I'll describe. It basically is derived by going to the database, picking proteins at random, picking pairs of SSEs at random, and then making this table. What is the odds in unrelated proteins chosen at random of getting a certain residual between the endpoints of the vectors?
And
these are unrelated structures. Actually, I'm saying it backwards. Right, you do it two. Here's unrelated. Yeah. Obviously, this is related because the peak is there. So you do it two ways. You go to unrelated proteins, and it actually doesn't matter much how you pick related and unrelated for this project. Sorry. Thank you, Richard. And then you make a log odds table. What's the relative frequency in related versus log frequency of related versus unrelated proteins for superposition residuals of endpoints of vectors? And this gives you a rather unsurprising scoring scheme that says, well, I get 2 points if I superimpose at zero. I get 1 point if I superimpose at two angstroms. I get no points out to about superimposing around 4 angstroms, because this is near the background. And actually, it's more likely to superimpose in unrelated proteins to these high RNSs. So you get a score. This is how we score the matches of individual vector pairs.
Do you superimpose only the C alpha or
psi-2? This is the endpoints of axial vectors of secondary structure elements. There are no C alphas yet. You've fitted an axis. And there is a trick about adjusting the lengths of them, so that I skip that.
When you say score, that's like a p-score or something.
Yeah. This is the equivalent of the PAM 250 table for structures. It is basic, almost. But this is the elementary scoring scheme that's derived by looking at the database and distributions. How do we do the significance test? There's three quantities, basically. We use these scores, we've got a clique, we add it up across all the independent SSE vectors. This gives us a score for an alignment. I go to unrelated proteins in the database. I choose pairs of secondary structures at random and build a frequency table of root mean square residual and angstroms versus frequency.
How do they orient?
How do you orient? Yes, right. You do the best superposition, right? That's correct. In order to get the residual. Right, there's 4 points at the endpoints of two vectors. We superimpose the four.
That's the distribution that you get.
That's the distribution that you get. Right. And then you.
It's not possible to use those lower numbers.
Right. You take the log of the frequency ratio. So it's a log odd score. And that's what this score is.
The ratio of the frequencies related towards
unrelated. Yep. And it, I mean, it's almost a line. It just says, okay, well, lower RMS is better score. So it's very unsurprising, but I mean, it's the actual value of the scores comes out of the statistics, not the.
So that means that if I, when I do this sum, if I have a pair of residues that have nothing to do with each other or whatever, I add in a very large negative score, a very large negative number.
Yep.
What would otherwise be a good alignment.
Yep.
This answers the question whether if you get the value of 6, how significant it is relative to what you would have gotten had there been random comparison. It's not a residue for residue score.
No, it's endpoint vectors. Well, this is only for a pair of vectors, this score. When you make an alignment, you sum up across the many different pairs of aligned vectors that you have in a clique. This is for SSE pairs. That's the elementary unit of similarity is a pair of SSEs superimposing with some score. No, those have an infinitely negative score. You only allow betas.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys are good. All right, how do you now make a significance test? This, what you need to know is the probability of seeing the score that you did by chance, given that you aligned in SSEs, SSE pairs, really. You also need to know, in comparing the two proteins that I looked at, how many different choices of alignment did I have? This is the search space size. And if you're doing a database search, you have to say, well, I actually tried to compare my query protein against many others. So there's a multiple test correction to think about. So these are the quantities one needs to know in order to compute an E value for a given alignment. The way we get this probability, what's the odds of seeing a given score by chance, is basically to assume independence among the different SSE pairs that are found in an alignment. And so we make a probability density function based on score, again going back to the database and saying, if I draw SSE pairs at random for unrelated proteins, saying it right this time, and then I assign the score that we did, what's the chance? It's just kind of very similar to what I showed you before, but it's now the score rather than the RMS. Well, you're only, these distributions are only pairs of SSEs, right? And it's only pairs, you know, the elementary, you build the empirical distributions only for pairs of SSEs. And then what you do to build, get the probability I was telling you for longer alignments is basically, you know, construct these density functions. And then you do a convolution of the density functions that says the probability of having two SSE pairs instead of one is actually the convolution of the density functions of one. You assume they're independent. And there's some math about getting these tail densities, but this is the function I was telling you. What's the odds of getting a given score by chance for an alignment of any length is determined mathematically from these distributions for the two alignment of single SSE pairs. So this is a theory, by the way. The only empirical thing that went in there was the distribution functions for SSE pairs.
But it seems you could test this by doing whole comparisons.
Well, sure. Well, we've done that. But and also, I just showed you one with BAST, you know, and what it.
Oh, no, found, but what I'm saying is do whole comparisons of randoms and such and see whether you get.
Yes. You begin to run out of data quickly for larger view, but for two clicks you have a lot. Anyway, so that all of that story here was how do we get this probability? What's the odds of seeing this score by chance, which means if I was picking SSE pairs at random out of unrelated proteins, what's the odds I'd find 10 of them that had the scores that summed up to the value that I saw? In Pardon? Back? Ah. Yes. They don't really. That's just, it's just an illusion. This is the curve for two SSEs. This is the curve for three. This is for four. I guess they do cross each other. I don't. All that's saying is, I don't know offhand.
At a certain point, it seems to be suggesting at a certain point it's easier to have a high score with fewer elements than with more elements or something like that, or numbers.
It's saying that it's becoming very unlikely to go up in score without adding more SSEs. That's what it's telling you. Yeah.
Or this score, basically, if it happens in fewer domains, then it's more significant than.
Yes. That's right. That is, the score, to find a score of 10, well, let's put it down here, to find a score of 5 going up becomes, you know, much easier as you have larger and larger alignments. In fact, you can't help but find a score of 5 if you have several SSEs aligned because you're summing up these scores. So anyway, we can work these out up through the longest alignments we have about 100 SSEs in them. So we have to actually do this out a long way, but it's just the computer does it. We also need to know this search space question. I've compared two proteins. Each of them has 50 SSEs in them. I found my best alignment, best scoring alignment, had 30 SSEs in it. How many different alignments were there that I could have constructed? Right, because if my score for my best alignment is, oh, this has only a 1 in a million chance of being, you know, occurring at random if I draw SSEs at random from unrelated proteins. But I've let myself search over 20 million alternative alignments. It's not very surprising to find that the best one has the 1 in a million score. And so you actually have to know this search space size. It's the same thing that happens in sequence comparison. Yeah, you're going to get an E value by multiplying the P with the search space size.
It's interesting, though, because these are not isolated examples. I mean, so there are all sorts of correlations between the various clicks. So it's not like you have independent measurements.
Right. This is a very conservative threshold in that sense. That's right. But the fundamental independence assumption is just that if I superimpose two SSEs, that doesn't cause me to superimpose a third one necessarily.
So I'm just sort of thinking that, for instance, if there's one that's very good, it will be replicated in lots of the combinatorial clusters.
Yeah, although the cliques have to be distinct.
Right.
So anyway, there's a simple recursion that you do with a dynamic program to calculate this search space size. And I just worked through an example of what these little strings represent is beta, beta, alpha, alpha, alpha for one protein. And I say, if one protein had this secondary structure architecture, beta, alpha, beta, the other one had this, beta, beta, alpha, 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 how many ways are there to construct an alignment of one strand and one helix in that order? And the answer is 6 for that example. You can sort of just count them. When they get long, you need a program to do the counting, but it's...
Almost exactly the same three dimensions structure, except that the structural elements were not collinear. If you look in space, it's just exactly the same, but they had some loop splicing in such a way that the arrangement, the long sequence, was completely blurred compared to it. Do I make myself clear? You could have like an upgoing helix and then a beta strand and another upgoing helix, but you could also have a helix going this way and then coming to the second helix first and then coming back.
Right.
But it would be exactly the same space.
Right. Yeah, this is often called by the protein structuralists as a topological similarity versus a meaning that the connectivity between the pieces matters. So here there's one number you tell the one parameter to tell it don't consider the connectivity. So there's another version of VAST that doesn't do that, but for finding biologically interesting protein neighbors, it's not actually very relevant to do what you describe, because the genetic mechanisms of molecular evolution only very rarely do a permutation of the kind that you describe. And so if you're interested in finding homologs, you pay a price of statistical power if you allow the program to do that. So one might think you're going to find more similarities if you turn off the requirement for topological, chain order connectivity. In fact, actually just the opposite happens, because the background of how many similarities you find by chance goes way up when you relax the, so that's the C. There's
proposing is plausible as substructures in various proteins with much more probability than what you say. Is that not true? I mean, supposing I find that you look at even protein L and protein G, which are things that some people talk about. There you essentially have two hairpins which is spliced across by alpha helix. And if I look at the substructures, it is a strand helix or strand helix strand. That occurs very often with protein G and protein L occur very often in that.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's possible that substructures could happen like that.
Oh, they do. Oh, absolutely. If one is interested in sort of cataloging the way helices dock on sheets and so on with a few pieces, then that general principles of protein architecture, the non-topological comparison is relevant to. I agree with that. Finding homologs is, I think you actually want to use the require the topological similarity. So anyway, you put those pieces together and you get an E value, right? So if you heard about other structure comparison, this is a very different way of getting E values than anyone else does, actually. Because we get these P's not by curve fitting, but by the theory that I described. And we calculate the search space explicitly with this combinatorial formula. And so it's a very theoretical kind of method, in the sense that the only empirical data that went in was the distribution of the 2 SSE score. What's the background for choosing 2 pairs of SSEs? What's the frequency of getting a given score by chance? So if this theory corresponds to what people find, I mean, that's the question, right? Does it correspond to what others have done with more rule of thumb type? And the answer is it kind of does, I think. But again, you're comparing phenotypes. There's no absolute standard of truth for any of these.
Yeah. Except that what you could actually do is look at the distribution of E values for random sequences, and that should be exactly what you would expect it to do.
Yeah. Yeah, we did that. You can't go very far, but it looks... Okay, so what is the consequence of this? Well, one of them, that is something that not everyone who does structure comparison thinks about, is that structural similarities are context dependent. That is, if I can find 5 SSEs that superimpose very well, that's much more surprising if the two proteins I'm looking at only have 6 SSEs than it is if they have 20. And that's because this search space term will be much, much larger when I have proteins with 20. And it's like BLAST. If I you know, I have a huge database I search and I find a similarity. You know, it's, if I make the database a lot smaller, you know, what you expect by chance changes. So, and in proteins, because there's this law, there's no gap penalty. You have an extreme expansion of the search space as the protein gets bigger.
So in other words, if I have two homologous proteins, and I take this one and I just attach on another domain that's a lot larger,
it will dilute the significance, absolutely. And that means you have to do the comparison by domain. Because you can have a protein with five immunoglobulin domains strung together. If you compare it against a single immunoglobulin domain, it will never be a significant similarity, even if the structures of the one domain are identical. So you need to break the requirement for this method is really that you break the proteins into domains when you compare them. So that's a big protein, and the different colors are the algorithm we use to break it into domains. So that's a criticism one can make for the method, that it requires that. Or you can put in a gap penalty, which is how a lot of other people. Of course, there's no pure physical theory about how you should define domains, and there's certainly none about how you should define gap penalties. Let me skip all of this. We actually have to make those pictures like I showed in the beginning of protein superimposing. Once you've found a significant alignment at the level of the SSE pairs, you have to expand this into a C-alpha carbon-based alignment, because you need that to interpret the similarity. So there's a story that I will skip. We use a similar statistical analysis to come up with a definition of how do you balance the trade-off of RMS residual versus number of points you've aligned. Again, you just go to the database of unrelated proteins and build up a statistical table, and that's a kind of picture of it. And this lets us decide what is the optimum alignment at the level of alpha carbons. And again, you've already decided the proteins are similar. You do that at the level of SSE vectors. That's how you get the method to go fast. Once you decide there's a significant similarity, you refine a C-alpha based superposition using that score function. That's how FAST works.
When looking at some deposition of animal structures in PDB on same proteins by some different groups, given very limited things that I've done, you come across situations when the assignment of the second structure itself is somewhat different. And so would that affect, it's clearly the beginning and end orientation like this can change.
Oh yeah.
Depending upon which guy you talk to. So how does that affect?
Well, the very beginning of the VAST project was clearly it's essential that you have a uniform definition of secondary structures across the proteins you're going to compare. You can't take what PDB told you because it's so heterogeneous. Nor can you take what you get from several of the well-known programs that look at hydrogen bonds and so on, because they tend to shred helices and beta strands for poorly determined structures. So you actually, they're making a secondary structure parser to identify in a robust way. That's how we actually began the project. It's what we give away in Entree. When you go look at any of these pictures, that's what you get. And so it's available, or you just have to download it.
I think it's just a PSSP file or something like that.
You can get GenBank flat files and read the GenBank feature table for proteins from PDB and get our definitions that way. There's also, you can download a program and use it with a little more work, but...
So in the final stage, you do align the C-alpha carbon.
Yep.
To score. So what happens if some second structure is just slightly longer than others, and you throw them away because the C-alpha doesn't align very well?
No, you do a refinement. It's a distance matrix Monte Carlo algorithm to search for the alignment at alpha carbon. And you seed it with pieces of alpha carbons, the alpha carbons that were within the SSEs, but you allow it to adjust the alignment, including to grow it. So the final alignment is not constrained by the boundaries of the secondary structure pieces in any.
So I'm not sure that I fully understand what you're telling me.
Sorry.
You have now a robust assignment, Bryant assignment.
Yeah.
But the Woodford might say that that is crazy for this particular protein. The Bryant doesn't. I'm on the business experiment. I'm telling you.
Yeah, but the important thing is when we build this curve, we have to use the definition that we're going to use when we search. They have to be consistent. So I will never argue with Kurt Ludrich. Yes, you do great helical assignments, but we have to do them in a uniform way. Otherwise, we can't do the statistics of this problem.
So he's willing to do it for all proteins.
Yes, if he wants to go do VAST or something like it, more power to him. But anyone who's going to build a method based on SSE comparison is going to have used some kind of uniform definition across the proteins.
So my question really is, what if I admit errors, how far the robustness of the scores, how have they changed?
Well, I mean, we've tried this with varying definitions of the SSEs. I don't think that's a very critical factor. What's critical, what you can't do is use something like DSSP that looks at hydrogen bonds, where it basically works like a scissor and shreds the protein into a bunch, many small SSEs, because you're looking at a very high resolution difference, and what you want to detect is overall similarity of the fold. And so I think that's the only important thing I ever learned from looking at the differences in secondary structure parsing. Well, they may be drawn into the refined alignment, but they're ignored, and it's an issue in the initial comparison. For example, they're very small proteins with lots of disulfides that bind to metals often don't have any secondary structure elements, and so they are invisible to VAST. So to the extent that that happens in proteins, this method won't find the similarities. Okay, refined alignments. There's a consequence of this curve.
But it seems like this would be, you right now have a very restricted library of secondary structure elements. I mean, if you included metal binding sites and disulfide bonds and all sorts of other things, I mean, or omega turns, or...
Yes, we're aware of that. You can expand the method by defining SSBs for disulfide bonds, and in addition to SSEs, and you can expand the library of fragments and use a similar method. That is not an easy line of research to pursue because, again, they're phenotypes. You have to choose what features you think are important for comparison, and you're going to have to test. So, but it is quite feasible to extend the method that way, I believe. That would be, in fact, the way to address this question of not finding relationships between small disulfide-rich proteins, for example. Okay, we do the realignment refinement. It's a little, all the methods that you will ever hear about in structure comparison also differ in how they make this curve, basically. How do they balance the trade-off of superimposing more alpha carbons with superimposing them better? Because those two are always opposed, and you can make, if you only superimpose one, the RMS is zero by definition. In fact, if you only superimpose a few, it's in practice near zero. So anyway, the way VAST works, it's rigid body superposition, and this statistics-based scoring scheme tends to make rather shorter alignments with low RMS. That's the systematic difference with Dolly, for example. This is Chris Sanders' method. And that's just an empirical observation, but if you go compare the superpositions, they'll look like that. And you could also think back to the CE method in this long helix and see that, well, actually, they're weighting the other way. They want very low RMS and don't care about how many SSEs they've matched. So anyway, there's a whole zoo of these different methods. And okay, so how do we know, just get back to the question, I mean, is this any good? Well, the only proof is that you find interesting things. So,
let me ask you a question. I mean, one of the questions is sort of how clumpy things are. How often do you get things that are surprising? So if you were to do just a histogram of e-scores, you know, is it that there are some things that are surprising, some things that are somewhat surprising, some things that are somewhat noticeable, and then, or is it that it's sort of lumpier, that you have lots of things that are not surprising at all, and then lots of things that are extremely surprising with not very much in
the Yeah, protein. It's the latter, if you just look at comparing all the proteins. That's, I mean, there's always a twilight zone. That theory I showed you always makes a cut, that this is not interesting, and you could, if you change it by, you know, one-tenth of a log, then, okay, you'll find something additional. But
I guess the question is how well-populated is the twilight zone? You're saying it's not very
well. Well, you're, in the twilight zone, you're starting to go up. You're cutting it where you're starting to see lots of things. And then you've got a big clump of the things that are very similar to one another that are very distinct from that. But the theory actually cuts at the point where you're starting to see a gazillion more. So if we change the p-value threshold from 0.05 to 0.1, we get 10 times more alignments. I mean, these really, because I think they're noise, but that's...
Which is interesting, because you'd only expect twice as many.
Well, okay, I'm exaggerating, right, yeah. It works like you would expect, but you get, it's going up rapidly. Anyway, so it's time for a break. Do we get interesting neighbors? This was just going to be an example. You study neighbors of NADH peroxidase, and you find that I find proteins that bind this cofactor in a very similar way, even though the existence of the cofactor, certainly its orientation, is not considered by the method at all. And this includes proteins that, according to Alyosha Mersin's scope classification, a supposed human expert, have different folds and are unrelated to one another completely. And yet, Bast finds that they not only have a big common core structure, but they bind the same cofactor in the same orientation. So do you find things that human biologists who looked at this problem didn't? Yeah, you do sometimes. And so I think that, in the end, is the only proof that you've done something interesting with these.
Does it work the other way? Does Scott make comparisons that you...
Absolutely. It works the other way, and one can debate about them. Mm-hmm. It's, anyway, these are, you know, under 10%. They're very dissimilar. They're not things you find by sequence at all. Now... The surprise is that, well, it's surprise. It's just a difference between what a human expert did, basically put the dinucleotide binding proteins in a different fold than mononucleotide binding proteins, because one of these is a mononucleotide, the other is a dinucleotide. But in fact, if you compare them, you see that the binding of the mononucleotide portion is identical, or extremely similar. So this is... we wrote a paper noting that, but since many other people have noted various holes in the scope classification. So it's just all, what does it say? It says the automated method suggested something that the human hadn't before. So now it's time for a break. There's a whole, I'm going to skip this whole story. How do you define homologs? How could you possibly sort out proteins that are homologous from ones that are not? And it's a very simple idea, and it doesn't work perfectly, but maybe I should skip all that because it's break time.
Let's have a break in 10 minutes.